Good morning, everybody. Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm on the West Coast, so I don't have my old setup. Like the lights are a little funky, sorry. So let's just take a moment to settle in before we start. And perhaps acknowledge that these are very, very, very difficult days for our human community. So, as always, we begin whatever we do by acknowledging and taking refuge in the living example of peace in the Buddha. And the guidance for how to conduct a life that is peaceful and wholesome in the Dharma. And those who have shown us how to do it in the Sangha. And then, of course, along with that, we take great delight in the fact that we have Dharma brothers and sisters. Like all of us here, to share the ups and downs of the path and the ups and downs of our life altogether. Sometimes the proverbial path seems, how can I say, a little bit exalted, exotic, but actually all we have to do is look at the news to see how down to earth and deeply consequential our minds are, our individual minds, our collective minds. In creating the world. So, as always, I'll just make a few comments, and to try to capture perhaps where we most of us are or might be in this course. We're coming to the end of the course. And in sections, I wanted to just chat in sections 5 or 6 and check sections 5 and 6 in the course, as you already know, are the sections that cover Mahamudra Shamatha and Mahamudra Vipassana. And so for some of you, this is somewhat new exploration. For some of you, you've been playing these chords for decades. But I wanted to just go over it one more time, as Mingyur Rinpoche did. For those of you who are newish to this, to develop some real clarity about why shamatha and vipassana meditation practices are so consequential, why they're such a big deal, why they're so important, why they're worthy of us coming back to for decades to come. And then those of you who have been on the path for a long time, this is important to remember to refresh our understanding and also perhaps to give some language when we need to talk to ourselves about why it's helpful to get on a cushion, when we talk to others about the profundity of working with these principles of calm, abiding, and insight. Also, to highlight to some degree the subtleties and perhaps some of the distinctions between what the way some traditions treat calm abiding, some traditions treat vipassana, and the way in our tradition we do it. So, as we know, the basic point of calm abiding meditation is to allow us, perhaps for the first time, to really discover our mind. And the critical thing about discovering our mind is because, as we know, everything is experienced by mind. Every single moment of our experience, good, bad, indifferent, ups, downs, breakthroughs, breakdowns, every single moment of our life is experienced through this somewhat miraculous lens of mind. And so if we want to affect our life, to work with our life, to work with our experience, and by extension, to be able to work with others' experience, we have to work with this mind. It's like an astronomer. If you want to look out into the heavens, and you want it to be clear, which is the definition of mind, by the way, clear and knowing. If we want to work with the sort of universe, but if our lens is dusty or scratched or wobbly, then the entire universe that we experience is changed. As Anais Nin said, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. This is why it is so critical to learn to really be with mind. So in Mingyur Rinpoche's tradition, and I think it's fair to say very particular to Mingyur Rinpoche, that he uses this word, the word for this meditation. Sometimes is the word is called drempa, sometimes it's called rigpa, sometimes those are condensed to drenrig. But Mingyur Rinpoche makes a very, very clear distinction right in the beginning that what we're working with is this quality of awareness. This is critical, and the reason that I bring it up again and again, because we need to remember it ourselves. And again, if we talk about meditation with someone else, the distinction is extremely important that in the general discussion of mindfulness meditation, the idea is that we take an object and we use that object to as a focal point for monkey mind. Because what we're working with is we're working with the agitated surface quality of mind. And so in mindfulness, the proverbial mindfulness tradition, the idea is that you take an object and you focus on that mind as a way to hold mind, to sort of hold that monkey. In Mingyur Rinpoche's way of talking about this, that we don't need to do this. What we need to do is simply know, to simply be aware. And being aware, we are being present to mind's capacity to know. This is what mind means. Again, technically, mind means that which is no clear and knowing. And so in the path of meditation, we're discovering mind, perhaps for the first time. So Mingyur Rinpoche makes this very important distinction that here we're working with a subject based, in other words, working with the awareness that is present here, rather than an object based, working with using an object out there to hold on to monkey. So there's a lot to say about this. One is that we understand that this agitated aspect of mind, we could say it's the liveliness of mind. It's the play of mind. It's the display of mind. There's a lot of beautiful words. And just like working with a child, we don't want to overtrain that child. We need the creativity. We need the liveliness. Because as we move forward in our understanding, And as most of you know, that when we begin to talk about working with emotions, for instance, we need the liveliness of the emotions because they are wisdom themselves. The emotions become wisdom themselves. So we need that. In fact, in the Vajrayana tradition, there is a vow not to discard the emotions, but because we need them for their wisdom energy. So one of the ways that I think about working with the practice of shamatha meditation is that what we're going to do with the method, whether it be following the breath, listening to a sound, body sensations, a mantra, a visual object, whatever it might be, we can use any one of the senses. Is that in some ways you could say what we're doing is we're giving this sort of agitated monkey, just like a baby in a high chair, we're giving it something to do. We're giving it just enough to do so that it's almost like we're distracting it with a more virtuous distraction. Monkey goes like this, and you say, "Okay, monkey, now let's follow the breath." Okay, breathe, breath, breath. We don't need to train to follow to breathe. Of course, that's ridiculous. But what we do is we give a place for that agitated energy to sort of resolve itself, to settle itself. It's very subtle. The example would be like in a ballet studio, they have a ballet bar, I think, around the wall. And my guess is that ballet students, they don't need to hold on to that railing in order to stand up. I might need that, but generally I would think dance students don't need that. What they use a ballet bar is simply to orient the whole system, the whole body in space. So I think that we can think about working with the support for meditation in that way as a kind of orienting principle. And then over time, we don't need that orienting principle and we can let it go in completely. And then in the shamatha tradition, in the beginning, that letting go completely is what Mingyur Rinpoche refers to as open awareness or shamatha without a support. So right in the beginning here with Mingyur Rinpoche, what we're doing is we're working with that natural openness of mind. So the question of effort is very important too. And we'll talk about it a little bit more, but generally, the effort is very subtle, very, very subtle. So another consequence of this, and then another consequence of this, which is very important, is that as you've read, and as you may already know, mind has the ability to know itself. We say to illuminate itself and to know other, to illuminate other. Mind has the quality of lighting up the environment, lighting up with knowingness, just knowing oneself and other. This is the quality of mind. So because of that, Mingyur Rinpoche uses a very, very important example that goes all the way through the tradition, all the way to the end. He starts using this example in The Joy of Living, which is when you're meditating, if you're just resting in awareness, because awareness knows itself, like a candle, a lit candle, the candle illuminates itself. And consequently, we don't need a flashlight to look at the candle. So this is critical now at the beginning when we're working with calm abiding meditation and open awareness. We don't need to watch our awareness. That's completely superfluous at this point because awareness knows itself. And this same instruction is the core instruction all the way through to working with nature of mind. Nature of mind knows itself. So we don't have to apply a second mindfulness to be mindful of that awareness. We simply need to rest in the awareness itself. This point will come up again and again and again, and is sort of the answer to about 75% of all meditation questions. So in the classic tradition, we say that meditation has three qualities. And I wanted to just dig into this just a little bit so that we can remind ourselves when we sit down, we can remind ourselves of these qualities. Because if we're if we're not clear about what we're doing, we're going to default to old ways of thinking, old ways of being, including things like, well, today, for once and for all, I'm going to shut monkey up. Now everybody says, oh, I never feel like that. That's not my attitude. But I promise you, in there is a part of you that says, oh, today, monkey's going to shut up. Finally, I'm going to get some peace and relief. And you say, no, I don't really think that way. And then at the end of your meditation, you think to yourself, oh, monkey was pretty quiet. Things were going well. So this is why we have to talk about this. So the three qualities of meditation. The first is what we refer to as non-meditation. So this is real here. This is real. This is not some sort of clever toss-off for Westerners. This is actually the way it is. The essence of meditation here in our tradition is non-meditation. I've mentioned many times before, but it's helpful to nail it down. One time I was with Migyur Rinpoche's father, and we were in his retreat room, which is where he always was. And his retreat room was extremely small. And he was just sitting there. And I blurted out, I said, well, Rinpoche, what are you doing? Because he never seemed to do anything. And without missing a beat, he said, can't an old man practice non-meditation? So this is the practice. So Nyingma Rinpoche's commentary on this is that this quality of non-meditation is the ability to simply be, just to simply be. Sometimes it's referred to as effortlessness. Non-meditation here is the exhaustion of effort altogether. And Mingyur Rinpoche has recently started making a very beautiful point. He said, this ability to simply be with whatever is, this is the beginning of wisdom. Right in the beginning. And because we always talk about view, this is where the view comes in. Right in the beginning. We can afford to simply be because because our being is already perfect. There's nothing to do with it. We don't need to do anything about it. It's already complete and whole, unchanging. We just need to allow ourselves to be present with that, to simply be, just be. Someone asked Khandra Rinpoche about working with her Buddha nature. Khandra Rinpoche said, I'm not working with my Buddha nature. I'm working with my human nature. Awareness. The presence of awareness, the stability of awareness, our own nature, whatever. There's nothing to do about that. It's unchanging. It's unchangeable. So we don't need to meditate on it. We don't need to change it. We simply need to learn how to be. And as I said before, we can simply be. Because when we allow mind to just be, it simply rests in itself. Did you have a question? You're muted.
Is it? I didn't hear who you asked.
Think you're still muted for some reason, right? I can't hear you. There you go. Okay.
Did you say Anu?
Yes.
Ah, sorry. So it is me. Sorry. I didn't want to interrupt your talking, so I'm happy to wait
That's
until
okay.
you've.
I like getting interrupted. I bore myself, so interruptions are good.
It is relevant. It is relevant. It's. Please excuse me if I do read a little bit. I was reflecting on my responses to the guided meditation from Mahamudra Vipassana. And there were a couple of things that Myoshin said that I had quite a strong reaction to. Now, I know that
Are you
Mari...
asking, are you going to ask about shamatha or vipassana?
Well, Vipassana more. I
Let's
don't
wait
know.
for a few minutes then.
Yeah,
I'll come back
sure.
to vipassana.
Sure,
Okay.
sure, sure,
Yeah.
sure.
So the first quality is this quality of non-meditation, the ability to simply be. What a relief. The second quality is similarly critical, which is the quality of non-fabrication. Being willing to not fabricate our experience, to simply be with whatever is going on. This, in fact, this is the discovery of peace. Right here. This is the discovery of freedom. This is what it means to be kind to ourselves. This is everything. To use a term that Sogyal Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche's brother, often uses, this is just the quality of okayness. Just non-fabrication. Non-fabrication here means we don't have to block a certain state of mind. We don't have to create a certain state of mind. We don't have to hope for something other than what we're experiencing right now. It is okay. It is fundamentally okay. One of my beautiful quotes that some of you have heard that relate to this, this comes from the Irish poet and philosopher, the late John O'Donohue. He said, "There is a place in you where you have never been wounded, where there's still a sureness in you, where there's a seamlessness in you, and where there's a confidence and tranquility in you. And I think the intention of prayer and spirituality and love is now and again to visit that kind of inner sanctuary. Just to come back, just to experience okayness." What a relief. This is peace. By definition, this is peace. When we're not fighting with ourselves, this is peace. This is what it means to be friends with ourselves. This is everything. I mean, how many of us secretly use our meditation practice or our Dharma life altogether to kind of harass us? We are strange people. So then the third quality, if the first is the ability to simply be, called non-meditation, the second is non-fabrication, the third is non-distraction. So non-distraction is quite simple here. How can we say the opposite of non-distraction isn't focus? Then the opposite of non-distraction is to just simply be, just to be present with whatever's going on rather than somewhere else. So what does non-distraction mean? Non-distraction means that we aren't carried away. Whether we're practicing shamatha meditation or practicing nature of mind, it's just that we're doing what we're doing and that we're not carried away by something. So carried away means we get lost in a story, in a daydream, thoughts. The critical point here is this is really, really important because we have a sort of culture around meditation that sort of denies this. The point here is that whether we're working with shamatha meditation, we're working in nature of mind meditation, thoughts and emotions come and go, just like clouds come and go into the, you know, through the sky. The sky is never harmed. We don't need to block thoughts and emotions. In fact, we cannot block thoughts and emotions. We have no control over whether thoughts and emotions come into our mind. What comes into our mind is based on past causes and conditions. We literally have no control over it. There's a beautiful line in our tradition that says the difference between Buddhas and sentient beings, in other words, Buddhas and folks like us, is not what comes to mind. It's what we do with it. It's what we call the release. That's the difference. In many ways, personally, personally, I think the practice is actually to get distracted and come back. Every time we get distracted, we notice it, we come back. Then we're there doing nothing, just being, sort of without any fabrication. We're just, we get distracted again and we come back. Every time we get distracted and come back, we lay down that habit. We condition our mind to notice it spontaneously when we're distracted, to the point where at some point, even the impulse to become distracted becomes the natural prompt to return. So actually, this is the practice in so many ways. So this is, you know, sometimes they refer to effortless mindfulness, that we begin to get distracted and we just come back naturally. Then mind is deeply trained, deeply tamed. It's so beautiful. So this is collectively, this is what it means to begin to come home. Mind is racing around the world, as we've talked so many times. The mind is jumping all over the world through the sights and sounds and thoughts and emotions, trying to find what it intuits as possible, something that will give it some meaning, some consistency, some security, and it never works. And so what we do, what Mingyur Rinpoche's father always used to say, we need to come home. So this is what it means to come home. And I would suggest that when we begin to work with meditation, we come home and we begin to know ourselves in the first person, just directly, perhaps for the first time in our entire life. Because until then, everything is in relationship. You know, the infant is in relationship to the mother, and then the little child is in relationship to friends, and on and on and on. Our sense of being, our sense of who I am, always because it's an echo, it's a reverberation of something out there. No wonder we're lost. No wonder we're insecure. And so when we begin to come back again and again and again, there is something that we can't put a finger on. There is something that we find. It's a kind of what you could call, sometimes referred to as, a kind of groundless ground. We can't put our finger on it, but something shifts. And this can be a very visceral experience. I literally remembered the first time I had this. I could go back. It was in the meditation center between a break in Boulder, Colorado. I literally could go back to the step where something dawned on me for the first time in my life that actually there was something there. It was okay. So this is a little bit about shamatha meditation. Then I'm going to go over vipassana a little bit quickly. So vipassana, then, once we begin to develop a mind that is present, that is more flexible, that is more workable, then we attend that to the nature of things, the nature of reality. So calming the mind, actually, you could say, is in the service of seeing clearly how the world is. So that's what insight means. Clear seeing or vivid seeing. This is what vipassana means. So very, very quickly, there's three kinds of vipassana. In the foundational vehicles, we talk about vipassana, is the insight of impermanence, and there's no single self. This is what the Buddha taught. In the Mahayana tradition, the vipassana is the study using reason and inference and logic, the study of emptiness. And so in the Vipassana, in the Mahayana tradition, the clear seeing of the insight is emptiness. In the Mahamudra tradition, the insight is insight into the nature of mind itself. So in the Mahamudra tradition, in the earlier traditions, we use reason and inference and logic. These are investigations. In the Mahamudra tradition, the Vipassana is a resting Vipassana, that when we allow mind to rest evenly and openly, then by definition, when we're not trying to alter our experience, we're simply allowing ourselves to be, then by definition, we see clearly and vividly. And this is what we refer to as nature of mind. And then from the nature of mind tradition, the shamatha aspect, the calm abiding aspect, is the natural continuity of the nature of mind. That's the shamatha aspect. The clarity in knowing this is the, you can say, the vipassana aspect. Okay, so those are a little more comments than I meant to make. I got carried away. Anu, do you want to?
Yes. Hello, Tim. Hello, everybody.
Yeah.
First, I'm going to occasionally look down at some notes I made because I was reflecting.
Okay, try to keep it a little bit short.
I will try. I will try. Okay. It was two statements from Miyoshin's guided meditation that I've had a very strong emotional reactions to. I know. And I know that my emotions are a bit intensified, like a lot of people, because of what's happening in the world. I know that, but still. So for the motivation, Miyoshin says, I'm now going to engage in this practice so I can become a Buddha in order to help all beings recognize their true nature and become Buddhas. I'm struggling with that as a motivation because it feels too distant for me. I can have as a motivation arousing bodhicitta, you know, becoming more aware, more kind, doing what I can to help people. That's comfortable. But thinking I'm doing this practice to become a Buddha in a million years, and only then I've got to then lead other people to become, it just feels like this can't work for me as a motivation.
So
that's two, I have another, one more point, but that's the first one.
Okay, so let's start with that. So the word bodhicitta is used in different ways, in different contexts. So what I would encourage you is to take the four boundless attitudes as an aspiration, the development of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You develop this for yourself and then for others. Yeah. This is compassion. Mingo Rinpoche is very clear about this point. And in certain, is very clear about this point that bodhicitta engenders this commitment to go all the way to Buddhahood. So we're not there yet. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't, you can just imagine that as an imagination, as an aspirational thing. But now I would encourage you just simply stay with the four boundless attitudes, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity for oneself, because you are the first person you look at in the mirror. So that's fine. Work with that and then let it naturally. This will naturally happen because we are naturally boundless. We are naturally good. We are naturally compassionate. So I would back that down a little bit, because of course it's not possible for us to bring all beings to enlightenment. We're setting in, you know, it's like a young person saying, I want to go to the Olympics. Functionally, that's not possible. But it gives them inspiration in their life. Yeah. So yeah. I think yours is a good point. So feel free to back it down to the four boundless attitudes, and that we can work with on a day-to-day basis.
I can work with that. And one more, during the course of the guided meditation, Miyoshin says, rest in a deep sense of appreciation, knowing that everything your awareness touches is perfect just as it is. That's aggravated by world affairs this week. I'm so far from seeing everything as perfect, just as it is. I've no serious grumbles about my own life, but when I look around me at the world, I'm far from seeing everything as perfect, just as it is.
So this is a good question. So what this says is that by nature, in essence, everything is perfect. Despite the fact that the expression is so catastrophic. And that is why we have compassion. That is the actual reason why we have compassion, because beings are by nature perfect. And in not recognizing it, they create incredible grief for themselves and others. And that is the cause, the seed, the reason to have compassion. So it does not mean that the expression of things right now is perfect, that war is in any way perfect. That's not what that means. It means that that people in essence are complete and perfect. There's a beautiful line that says, beings have always been Buddhas, but not realizing it, they wander endlessly. Oh, I can't remember the exact line, but it's, you know, so does that make sense that in essence, everything is perfect? In the expression, samsara and confusion is devastating. It's devastating. So our job is to hold that heartbreaking paradox. Just like, Anu, are you a mother? Do you have children?
No.
Oh, just like if you had a, you know, like a little 5-year-old and you, or like a, well, maybe a 13-year-old when they turn teenager, you know, these little, this, you know, this little guy as a baby, he's perfect. He's wonderful. And he goes off and he's causing trouble at school and it's completely heartbreaking. That's what we hold together. We hold both of those things together. The knowledge of how beings truly are and the knowledge how ignorance causes such trouble. So this is why we have, this is why we have compassion. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
So would it be great? I would love it today if people who maybe haven't shared in the past would come forth. Lisa? Lisa?
There, sorry. How are you doing today?
Okay, thanks.
Hello. Thank you, everybody, for your prayers. I did have the surgery and just waiting for results. So that's not the question, but I did see some comments in the chat box. My question is, Tim, and what you were saying, but not recognizing this, they wander in samsara. That was the rest of that quote, and then there's another piece to that. When we rest in our mind, and the question I have and that comes up with me is to know, I know that resting in my mind, that's what's generating this wisdom, this understanding. And then I ask myself, and how is, because I know the innate qualities are wisdom, compassion, and love, how am I benefiting beings if I am to continue to come back to awareness, which is the non-fabrication part, come back, but yet there's this opportunity there to, oh, I have a thought of compassion, to benefit beings, to generate that. So can you speak on that a little bit?
You mean coming back to the thought of having compassion as opposed to coming back to awareness itself?
Exactly.
Well, awareness itself, is authentic non-conceptual compassion. That is compassion. Otherwise, it's conceptual compassion, which we use along the way, but it's not yet true compassion. So awareness itself, the nature, the essence of awareness is open and unfindable. The nature of that awareness is a constant radiation of love and compassion.
Okay, that's wonderful. Yeah, this has been something that has been bugging me, so that it's a constant radiance of love and compassion. Fine, I can work with that a little bit more. Thank you so much, Tim.
Yeah. In fact, I just came across, let's see if it's easily available, maybe it's not. Lou or Doe?
Thank you. I just wanted to go back to Anu's question for a second. Do you think the saying could be every being is perfect instead of everything is perfect?
What would the distinction be, or why would that be helpful?
Because it's not the war that's perfect. It's the beings who are creating the war. I think maybe that's what my confusion has been.
Yeah. I mean, if you dig in a little bit, everything is perfect in that everything is empty luminosity. But I don't think we need to worry about that distinction right now. So fine, then just work with all beings are perfect. That's good enough.
Thank you.
Yeah. Simonetta?
Hello?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, in fact, it's Catherine and not Simonetta, but I'm...
Just a second, could you start again? Start again, yeah. We missed you for a second.
Okay, it's not Simonetta, it's Catherine, and I'm with Simonetta on her PC. Hello, and I've got... I'm trying to activate the video. Can you see me? I don't know if you can see me.
Yes,
I can see you.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, fine. Just two things. First thing is I wanted to catch the Irish poet that you mentioned. I wanted to understand who that was because I thought that was such a beautiful poem. But you could always put it in the chat, but that's not my question. I wanted to say something about, in response to Lisa, something about, and I'm not very... Forgive me for not being able to articulate it clearly, but it suddenly came to me that the state of being, resting in awareness, is, and then there's a thought that comes, maybe a thought of compassion, as she said, is there's something that struck me about the difference between being a spectator and being a, an actor, being a someone who's, you know, maybe because I come from the theatre, but when you're performing, the experience of performing is very different to watching someone perform. They're two different experiences. And the spectator is often full of thoughts about what the performer's doing, whereas the performer is free of thought because the performer is just going through the prepared, is sort of in the moment, in a present with whatever the words are that they have to put across, whatever the action is, there's a sort of level of presence that's different. You're not in dialogue with yourself when you're performing, but the person spectating is. And so I suddenly felt like that when I'm resting in awareness, I'm a sort of I'm not spectating myself, but when I have a thought, it's like I'm commenting on my experience, and it's immediately from a spectator's point of view.
That's good.
You know what I mean? It's something.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, good.
That analogy.
I just came across yesterday a beautiful quote from Sokhmi Rinpoche. This has to do with this quality of naturalness of compassion, and he said, "You don't have to say anything. You don't have to teach anything. You just have to be who you are by opening your heart and mind." Yeah, I think this is it. Okay, Taylor.
That was a beautiful quote. Thank you. I just wanted to circle back to the thing about everything being perfect the way it is, because that's been on my mind too, pretty much around this recent conflict going on. And is there, at least in a relative sense, a certain amount of acceptance that of the way things are, as opposed to not approving of them, meant in that comment as well?
You know, it's very interesting. I've talked with Mingyur Rinpoche about this. Sometimes he's made the point that in order to be able to work with any situation, we have to accept the way the situation is rather than imagine it to be some other way. So for instance, you know, if you're rushed to the emergency room, the doctor has to accept this is what is here. And so there is a quality of acceptance, but it's not passivity. So often we think of if something is acceptance, that we're okay with it, that we're passive with it, that we don't want to change it. Not at all. We have to accept the situation in order to be able to work with it effectively, I think is the point. If that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it does. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, this has to do with equanimity of the four boundless attitudes, this quality of balance, you know. Yeah. Barbara.
Again, on this idea of everything being perfect, what I've sort of come to, and I wonder if this is incorrect or correct or somewhere in between. If we look at situations and understand the history that's come before, things become at least understandable and somewhat perfect in the sense of perfection being, it could hardly be otherwise. For example, if in the Middle East you look at the way generation after generation holds anger for how things have been, how people act now is based on that, and it could hardly be otherwise without the view that we have of Buddha nature, or on an individual basis. If someone has a really hard time hearing input, but as they grew up, their entire life was, they were told to be perfect. How could they be otherwise? In that sense, it's perfect. It's not positive particularly, but it could barely be otherwise without another view.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, which is, you're right, because things are the consequence of prior causes and conditions, things become what they are based on prior causes and conditions. So as you're suggesting, we could say that things aren't going to be some other way because the causes and conditions weren't there. You know, I've quoted my hero, Father Gregory Boyle, many, many times when he talks about standing, you know, in the sidewalks of Los Angeles with the gangbangers. And he said, not only do I not judge them, I stand in awe of the burden that they carry. So I think that there's something in there that we ground ourselves in, that sort of basic understanding of cause and effect and how heartbreaking that is. We can hold that. This is this odd paradox. We can hold that truth and also the disgust at the horror of inhumanity at the same time. This is complex. You know, what this will never be reduced to, you know what I mean? Platitudes or isms. It's just endlessly complex.
Yeah, I think that whole interconnection, you know, having that huge view helps. It doesn't, you know, and then there's arousing compassion, which is another step, actually. You know, if you really understand it, then there can be compassion.
It's one of the reasons why it makes compassionate activity possible, because if we change the causes and conditions, then the consequence is different. Things are never stuck. That's part of one of the many beautiful points about interdependence. Things are never stuck. Yeah,
right.
Really good.
Right. They're always changing. Right.
Yeah. Thank you. Christy.
Hi. I'm asking a question which may not be appropriate in this context, and it has to do with, but there's a line or a verse in the Nectar of Path liturgy that plays into this whole conversation. And so I don't know if it's appropriate to repeat that line.
Go ahead.
Should I?
By the way, I've added a couple of quotes in the chat box for folks. Go ahead, Christy.
So it has to do with the contemplating impermanence. And like waves in the ocean, all things are impermanent. I will accept whatever happens and make it my friend. I mean, now I've gone not only into the resting with the war and everything, but making it my friend. So I have had I've struggled a lot with that one. And what I'm arriving at is something to the effect of this is my opportunity to really work at compassion. Can you speak to the I will make it my friend?
You got it. That's right. That we'll take whatever arises to help us engender greater love, compassion, patience, exertion, understanding, wisdom, whatever it might be. So circumstance becomes a friend along the path. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great line. Cynthia.
Thank you, actually, for that last question. That line has always been my most difficult one in that practice, actually. Even though I understand it, it's the only one that rubs me a little bit the wrong way. But what I actually wanted to say on the topic before about this whole, you know, things being as they are based on causes and conditions, it reminded me of, there's a section in the Glimpses of Abhidharma book, which is one of my oddly favorites of Trungpa Rinpoche's books, which I know is a little unusual. Most people are not. It really talks very much about that same thing, about the fact that where we are, I'll actually read a little bit of it, that it's an attitude of pessimism and optimism together. The situation is fitting in that it is right, and it is fitting in that it is wrong, both at the same time. The two poles are constantly present. It's like basically acknowledging that, and the same thing for even our personal karma, that we are, you know, the product of everything that has come before, and yet we still have that opportunity right now to alter the course of future. So, you know, there's this notion that we're sort of like, it's perfectly bad and perfectly good both at the same time.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to hear that someone reads that book. Yeah, that's it. Thank you, Cynthia. Yeah, wonderful. Linda or Richard?
Hi, it's Richard here. Tim, I've got a question going back to your reference to it's like going into an emergency department and the doctor has to deal with what is. And having been in that position myself many times, the question I have is, in that context, I could be very clear, very caring, compassionate, do the job well, to see all that blood and disaster around me. That same that same experience out on the road, just as an ordinary person like everybody else, would strike me as horrific. And I would have much, sorry, I'm not hearing you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, but I can't hear you, Tim.
Tim is is muted.
Just keep talking. We can hear you.
Okay, I'll just keep talking until, and then hopefully, Tim, you can respond.
He'll respond later.
Okay, so out in the street, I would feel kind of horrified, just probably like most other people, to see carnage around me. So that was all very well and good. But what I found was that there was a sense of disconnection I had, essentially when I would come home. And if I would still be in that place of caring and seeing things from a wider, different perspective, that somehow disconnected me from the personal experiences that were occurring in my own home. So that touched back to what you had started by saying earlier, Tim, in terms of the practice of allowing everything and being with everything. And so how can one be with everything and yet not fall into that trap of disconnection or that obstacle of disconnection? I don't even see Tim.
I can see him, but he still has the mute button showing.
We cannot hear you, Tim.
Well, until Tim comes back, I would like to say that was a very interesting question, very interesting perspective. And is there any other member here of the Sangha, our little Sangha, has something to add while we wait for Tim?
I think I might have something. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
I went through quite a few traumas in my life and had to deal with a lot of disconnect. And for me personally, what really helped was doing Tonglen on myself. So showering compassion on myself and doing sending and taking on myself really made a difference. I think the disconnect, at least from my experience, comes from the overwhelm. You know, the mind and the heart is just overwhelmed, and the disconnect is a way to remove oneself from the intensity of the experience.
Thank you, Diana. And I think in one's medical training, that's exactly why one is trained, so as not to become overwhelmed.
Yeah.
The problem with that is then that one, as I said, I found personally would cut me off from very important connections on a day-to-day basis outside of that role. And yet what we've been asked to do and what I'm have been attempting to do is to somehow not have that barrier and not be overwhelmed.
Right. I think it's got to go step by step. Like, open, can I open a little bit? Because you've had this conditioning for so long.
I've practiced for 40 years.
Yeah. So one tiny little step at a time, right? Like, can I open a little bit to this? You know, it's, I think for me, one thing that really I understood was the difference between detachment and a discernment that provides a larger view of what's happening.
Lovely.
And I think, you know, I studied Yoga Sutra with a yogi from the Himalayas for 25 years. So Vairagya, the Sanskrit word, which we translate as detachment, he would always say that's not Vairagya. Vairagya is more than detachment, because it's very easy to detach one's reactions and responses to a difficult situation. But it's different to have a view that allows for discernment, where you're not engaged with the intensity of emotion, and you can see the emotional response as a human aspect that doesn't engage you in a way that bowls you over, that allows you to view the circumstance, as we were talking earlier, like, you know, as cause and effect, that you are a participant of. But if you can keep that position of vairagya, then, as you are alluding to, the ability to be compassionate is a completely different space than completely cutting oneself off emotionally and putting a barrier.
Yes.
Does that help?
Unfortunately, we can see you smiling, but we can't hear what you're saying. If I could just say one more thing about it, it was very slippery, so it was not an obvious disconnection.
Yeah.
And that becomes the challenge.
I think
it was very accurate and very helpful, but it's such a fine line where you don't believe you disconnected because you're so compassionate in the moment.
Right.
One is, or I found I was, outside of that area, I was in many ways disconnected.
Yeah. I mean, the other is body practice, right? Like getting into the feeling, purposely evoking the response, but in a controlled situation, like on the cushion, and feeling that emotion and knowing that, you know, the body holds on to all of this stuff. Even if we are disconnected, it's still there and it needs to, you know, be acknowledged.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But it's just hard to hold all that pain. It just is. I mean, we're embodied, and that's our great gift, and it's an obstacle as well.
Right. I think the key is to not hold, the letting go.
Yes, absolutely. That's what's worked for me.
Thank you.
And be okay with letting it go. I have a friend who's a Catholic priest who I know through yoga circles, and that was a big thing for him as all of his friends started passing away as he got older. He said, "I can't hold them all. I can't hold them all." And I just asked him very innocently. I wasn't, you know, trying to teach him or anything. I just said, "Well, why would you want to hold all of them? Why wouldn't you just allow them to be and who they were and just let them go?" And that shifted him drastically, to because he was suffering a lot trying to hold all this presence of all these, you know, elders in his community. But once he let go, then he became this embodiment of it, rather than trying to hang on to it. And I kind of think of that, it's the same way with when we acknowledge everyone else's suffering. You can't hold on to their suffering, but you can acknowledge it. And that allowance of letting it flow is what opens the compassion to flow.
Richard, I just posted a word, and I hope you could see it. I suggest you to read this beautiful book from Dr. David Schlim, which is entitled A Gentle Rain of Compassion. It's a fantastic book that you should read. It's very close to you.
Thank you. Oh, there it is. I see. A Gentle Rain of Compassion. Thank you.
It's been working. He was the guy, the doctor who brought the medicine for people who were suffering of altitude in Nepal. And he opened a clinic that was very important. And he worked with people. And he met with wisdom on his way. He met with Tuku Ojen. And then he met with Chogyam Rinpoche, who became his big friend. And his story is, you read that book like you would watch a film, and it's poignant. You want to read the next chapter all the time. But he brings about all the knowledge of Buddhism that comes into his work and that transforms his mind and his view of suffering, because he is in the midst of suffering in his work. He was actually in Nepal as a doctor.
Oh, can you guys hear me now?
Yes, you're back.
Yes, we do. Sorry.
No, that's because the mute button was on. Okay, so I'm sorry about that, everyone. So let's as always, let's take a moment to imagine that if anything good happened today, anything helpful, wholesome, affirming. Let's multiply it infinitely and just spread it out to the world that needs it so badly right now. Yeah, okay, everybody. I'm sorry for the sound glitch in the last minutes. And be well, and let's unmute and say goodbye. Thank you, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Saga.
Thank you.
Lots of love.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, team.
Goodbye.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.